Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. Economists, and probably your own eyes, have been telling you for years that income inequality is growing and upward mobility is harder. But who's to blame? Who's the problem? The ultra-rich? That fabled 1%? No, says my guest today, it's a lot more than that tiny share at the top of the economy. It's a sizable upper middle class that only wants the best for its own kids, who are getting in the way of everybody else's American dream. This hour on Point, the new middle class aristocracy. You can join us on air or online. Do you see a layer of your middle class community peeling off from the rest of your neighbors and flying higher? Do you say more power to them, or do you see something happening where it gets easier as you get wealthier and harder just to stay in place? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me in the studio today, Matthew Stewart, philosopher, former management consultant, and author of several books. He's out with an article in The Atlantic called The 9.9% is the New American Aristocracy. There's a link on our website, onpointradio.org. Matthew, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Ray. It's great to be here.
Who are these people? Who are these people who make up the 9.9%?
So we all know about rising inequality at this point. But when you take a closer look at the numbers, it turns out that some of our illusions about who they are inaccurate. There's this tiny sliver. It's much smaller than 1%, 0.1%, that have been the big winners in the economy. And we need to pay attention to them, by the way, just because my article tends to focus on the people just below that doesn't mean we should let those guys off the hook. They're playing a really critical and in some ways very destructive role in our economy. But then when you look below that, it turns out that you have people who certainly are wealthy by most people's standards, but they're not going to the casino and they're not the Donald Trumpsters of the world. They look more like ordinary people. It's more likely to be your divorce lawyer or your dentist or your doctor or MBAs with opaque job titles, as I call them. And I feel that we should maybe, Ray, before we go on, we should give them all a big hug because they're doing good work. And I think when one draws attention to the privileges that they have, it provokes a lot of defensiveness. But they do have a certain blind spot. And I should say we have a certain blind spot because I'm a member of this group. We don't seem to be aware that we're participating in a process. This is a process of class separation. And in a way, the real villain isn't any group of people. It's the process that separates classes and then leads them to then defend their turf and to act against the interests of the whole. And that's the process we're seeing. And I guess I'd like people to witness that in their own daily lives, to think about the things that they're going through as they are striving, as they should, and to try to see where they are, in fact, reproducing some of the class divisions that are growing in our society.
When I think about these people that you describe, they're not the plutocrats, but maybe arguably the courtiers to the plutocrats, the people who make the plutocratic life possible. They're writing code that helps execute stock trades. They're corporate attorneys. They're structuring people's estates. But one thing that they are at base is the rule followers. They've heard the big voices in the culture and heard what those big voices have said about how to get ahead, and they did it. And now some of them are saying, hey, Matthew Stewart, you get lost. I did what I was supposed to do, and now you're knocking me.
Yeah, I think, Ray, I think you really got it pretty accurately. They're saying that we're talking about the rule followers. We are also the people running the machine. So we are responsible at a fundamental level for the economic system that exists now. But at the same time, we need to be aware that our role in that system is not as constructive as we think it is, and that in following the rules, we've lost track of where we're going. I think we lack a certain tragic sensibility. We lack an understanding that even if we're following the rules, if the rules aren't quite working, we may be making things worse in the long run. And that's, I think, the main thing we have to appreciate, that just because you follow the rules doesn't mean everything's going to turn out right.
This class is really a product of economic processes of the last couple of decades. And even as this class was growing in size, growing in assets under management, we kept paying tribute to the system that helped create them. Accepting the presidential nomination at the Democratic National Convention in 1992, Bill Clinton, in his famous A Place Called Hope speech, outlined his optimistic vision for an American child's future.
Let it be our cause that we give this child a country that is coming together, not coming apart. A country of boundless hopes and endless dreams. A country that once again lifts its people and inspires the world. Let that be our cause, our commitment, and our new covenant.
Bill Clinton was the emblem for this argument about how American society works. He came from nothing, raised in part by a man who was not his own father, after his own father died before he was even born, a mother who cobbled together job after job after job to keep him afloat, and it was his smarts that got him to be a Rhodes Scholar, got him ahead, got him into some of the best schools in the country from a small town in Arkansas. He believed that story because he lived that story. Isn't there always still room for the Bill Clintons of 2018 and 2019?
Oh, sure. There's plenty of room. And I think that we need to bear in mind as we get into a sort of doom and gloom talk that a lot of America still works. That working hard still is a key to getting ahead. But I'd draw attention to an important historical fact that this isn't really a new phenomenon that we're witnessing in the United States. Inequality was as high as it is now in the 1920s, at the end of the Gilded Age. And there was an American dream before that. F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote about it. That's what The Great Gatsby is about. But it's about the collapse of the American dream. I think that we imagine that because this is America, the dream will always hold true. But in fact, it hasn't always held true in the past. And we're now exposing it to very serious risk. I mean, these trends will significantly undermine it. I think we look too much to personal anecdotes. There, so many of us, and I'm sort of in this category, can point to our own experience and say, look, I struggled. I made it. I did a lot by myself. I was better than the other people. But when you look at the bigger picture, there are a lot of people that can't say that. And there's more and more people in that category. And this is crucial. We're seeing that divide in some of the data, some of the sociological data. When you look at how people are living, you can talk all you want about the American dream, but how does that look to in regions where the average life expectancy has gone down?
If you were born into the bottom quintile in the American economic distribution, you are less likely to move up to the third or fourth. If you do manage to get up to the third or fourth, you are less likely to stay there. But part of the story also is that if you're born into the fifth quintile, you may not stay there your whole life as well. And a lot of American kids are feeling the anxiety of being faced with a world where they're not going to be able to live as well as they did when they were growing up.
Right. We should talk about that anxiety. I think that's a lot of fun. But there's some important things to know about social mobility in the United States. First, we like to think that this is the land of opportunity. But it turns out that if you compare the United States to other high-income countries, we actually don't rank very highly on that. And that's important to bear in mind. Here's the second crucial point, that it's actually been decreasing our social mobility. We don't like to face this fact, but the numbers show it pretty clearly. There's something called intergenerational earnings elasticity that tracks the dependence between a child's income and the parent's income. And that number was at 0.3 in the 1950s. That's to say that about 30% of the child's income could be predicted by the parent's income. Today, that's at 0.5, which means basically once you've chosen your parents, the game is half over. Those are basically raw numerical facts that I think we have to confront. And I guess the final point, and you were getting at this, Ray, it's where the immobility is most prominent that matters in the United States. So what are the sticky points in the spectrum? Well, it turns out that they're at the top and at the bottom. So the top quintile, and in fact the top decile in particular, that's the stickiest place in the United States, which is to say if you're born in that group, you have a much better chance of staying in that group than any other group has of staying in its group. And the same thing happens down at the bottom. And these are, again, numbers that you can find through international comparisons. And we frankly don't do well on that. So this is one of these deeply ingrained myths. It's very hard to attack. But the numbers are telling us something that we need to pay attention to.
On Facebook, Andrew writes, "It isn't wrong to want the best opportunities one can offer for one's children. The author places too much emphasis on getting into top-tier schools. On the average, relative mobility is realized through the middle-tier and lower-tier schools. I've witnessed immigrant students taking 18, 20 credit hours a semester at solid community colleges. Through motivation and human capital alone, many will eventually graduate with a professional degree and become very successful. And I don't see a problem with this." We will pick it up. We're talking about class, about social mobility, about getting ahead or falling behind in America. You can join the conversation. Do you see social status, gilded zip codes, desirable public schools, elite colleges becoming more important in this country? Are the well-off, whether they mean to or not, making life more uncomfortable for the merely comfortable, not to mention the downright poor and struggling? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about what my guest today calls a new American aristocracy. Upper-middle-class Americans who've done right by their families but may be holding everybody else back by locking in their gains. You can join the conversation. Did you get your kid into an Ivy this year? What did that cost your family in tutors, SAT prep, resume padding, internships? Should any decent college mean any good graduate in this country has as good a shot in the future as the kid who went to Harvard or Stanford? Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest this hour is Matthew Stewart. His article in The Atlantic is called "The 9.9% is the New American Aristocracy." Here's Jack Kemp accepting the vice presidential nomination at the Republican National Convention in 1996, a speech in which he sang the praises of democratic capitalism.
You see, Americans do not accept limits. We transcend those limits. We do not settle for things as they are. We are intent on succeeding.
Is Matthew Stewart this syndrome that you identify in your article with us because the American economy is not growing in the way that it used to, and such gains as it makes are not distributed in the way they used to be?
That's a great question and really important. I think that we are seeing the symptoms of an economic imbalance, which is to say, I think low economic growth and low economic performance is actually tied to this question. It's both an effect and a cause. What's happening is that we have significant sectors of the economy, and they're skewed towards those that involve people with lots of credentials, that can claim monopoly rents. We have significant monopolies in our technology and financial sector. These are the root causes of what we're seeing. They generate excess cash. Now, how does this excess cash filter around through our society? Well, we compete basically to get it. And that's what causes a lot of these distortions, the weirdness of the education marketplace. So I think everybody who's involved in it, and by the way, I'm trying just as hard as anybody else to get my kids into a nice school. Everybody involved in it appreciates that there's this craziness to the process. And the real question is, why? Why do we have to go through such a crazy amount of hoop jumping to give our kids good opportunities? And I think that the answer is that the rewards are not actually linked to the merit that we're putting in. So we have to put in the extra effort. We have to go through all this anxious activity in order to secure that extra advantage. And that drives everybody to work harder, drives everybody to compete more vigorously in trying to secure these nice little slots that sort of give you a ticket into the monopoly machine. But at the end of the day, it ends up being quite destructive. It ends up separating the classes and leading to political instability.
Hartford, Connecticut is our first stop. Roger, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I'd like to ask your guest, you know, everyone understands if you're an entrepreneur and you come up with some great product and you sell it and millions of people want to buy it, you make millions of dollars. There's a direct correlation there that everyone gets. But what I'd like to know is, and I think partly what you're talking about is, how and when did professional salaries at the upper levels become so inflated? You know, now your surgeon, your orthopedic surgeon who fixes your knee is making $695,000 a year. College presidents make $1 million a year. It's less, the mechanism by which this happens is less clear than if you're Bill Gates and you're selling bazillion units of something. So how did this happen and when?
Right. That's a terrific question. I think you get to really a big part of the problem. So it turns out that doctors in the United States make twice as much as doctors in other high-income countries, and that's relative to those countries' economic status. It's pretty astonishing, really. And we know that they're not any better at saving lives, right, because our healthcare system doesn't actually compare favorably with others. The same is true in a number of other American professions. To your question, when it started, I think the data shows that it's a big part of the rise in inequality over the last 40 to 50 years. So I think it's in that time frame that it has become particularly pronounced. But I can't say for sure exactly how it's where it's happened in the different sectors. But what is clear is that these particular professions, and it happens in a wide number. I don't want to pick on doctors too much because they're just one of many that are playing the same game. But they essentially claim a premium. And the way you access that premium in our society is you go to college and you go to the right college. So you can actually track this kind of market disequilibrium by looking at the college premium in the United States over time. That is, that measures how much extra money people earn by going to college. A lot of people want to explain that in terms of the skills economy and the knowledge economy and so on. And you know, my short answer to that is nonsense because it hasn't happened in a lot of other countries, right? The college premium is a lot lower in other countries. And if you track that over time, what you see is that in the 1950s, that college premium was around where it is in other countries like Japan and Germany, and it has since gone up by more than 50%, which is to say that somehow these credentialed professions have, in fact, managed to secure these rents. That's not the only mechanism, by the way, but I think it's really important to understand that and understand that trend.
Even when you look at the professions involved in manipulating money or engineering cash, somebody who worked at Brown Brothers Harriman in the 1920s did not make the kind of salary potentially that their equivalent at Goldman, let's say, 100 years later makes. They had a nice life. They had a suburban house. More metropolitan areas had short-haul rail to take them to the Coscobs and the Greenwiches and the Wilmettes and the Winnetkas. They lived a nice life, but the separation that they had between the people who were making the stuff of society was not as great as it is today.
Yeah, that's right. And I experienced that firsthand. I guess you can call it salary shock, because I in the 1980s I was a lonely graduate student in philosophy, and looking for a job, I wound up in management consulting for financial services, and I was stunned really to see the differentials, how big the gap is between the kinds of compensation that people expect in these professional arenas versus the sort of average American worker. And that has only grown, and it's grown dramatically over the last 30 years.
Jaso writes, I'm an upper-middle-class American, probably a 90%er, and I'm astounded when I hear peers complain about our lot in life. Talk about lack of imagination. Stroyant writes, I quote, I struggled and I made it. Those people reassure themselves that struggling is both necessary and sufficient to become rich. They never ascribe their success to unfair advantages or simple good luck. This is the fundamental myth of America, and it is destroying us. Richmond, Virginia is next. Joe, welcome to the program.
All right.
Hiya, Joe.
All your guests have pretty much touched on everything that kind of comes into play here. You know, the game is rigged, but people also don't set themselves up to take advantage of an opportunity when it presents itself. Your one guest was referring to the Wall Street crowd. That's society's stupidity for putting a priority on, your stockbroker versus the doctor that fixes your knee or fixes your spine. You know, when my stomach hurts, I don't call my broker, I call my doctor. You know, I can't work if I can't go to work because my doctor doesn't know what he's doing. But I can keep going if my broker's an idiot.
Joe, right at the beginning, you said the game is rigged. And we're looking at a country where the median household income is in the mid-50s. So if you're in the middle somewhere, what do you tell your own kids? Do you say, kids, the game is rigged, let's give up? No, don't you do a lot of the same things that the people up at the upper end are doing? But, you don't tell your own kids, don't strive, don't work hard. What do?
You tell them the truth. You tell them to set yourself up to take an advantage of an opportunity, play by the rules as best you can. Now, all of us know that the rules are rigged. For full disclosure, I'm a Republican, but I also know my representative was Eric Cantor. Okay, go back to 2008 when they had the financial crisis. Who do you think his wife worked for at one point? Was Goldman Sachs. Well, when he came up for re-election, when he voted for the bank bailout, guess what? We voted his butt out of office. And as a Republican, I'm proud to say we voted him out of office. Y'all used Bill Clinton as your poster child for, we'll say, the Democratic side. The only difference between Bill Clinton and Eric Cantor, one has an R in front of his name, the other one has a Democrat. And that is, you can boil everything down to people need to start facing the truth. Quit BSing yourself and trying to BS other people, not meaning you personally, but just people in general, and call a spade a spade, okay? And that is kind of really the root problem to this whole mess. I was on another NPR program a few months back. They had some economist from Yale on the Kathy Lewis show out of Norfolk, Virginia. He's on there whining and crying how the taxpayers need to support trade schools because there's such a shortage of tradespeople, which there is. But that's not the taxpayers' problem. That's the business community's problem. You know, people need to put a priority on what's really important. When my electricity don't work, I call an electrician or call a power company. I don't care what my broker does. You know, I mean, we can go on and on and on, but I think you kind of get the gist of what I'm saying.
Yes, Joe. And you know, you identify an interesting moment in American history where we are talking about government entities like community colleges training people for the jobs that are available in the current economy when 50, 60 years ago, companies trained people to work for them, trained you in what you needed to know. We weren't expected to know metallurgy when you came through the front door of Southworks, United States Steel in South Chicago. They took you through the front door and trained you and taught you what you needed to know. That's Joe in Richmond, Virginia. Atlanta, Georgia is next. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Welcome.
So my point was that when we talk about the game being rigged, I very much felt that when I was growing up, I grew up middle class, but I went to a wealthy school district. And when I did that, I couldn't afford to go on to college like the rest of my peers. I have been working since I was 15. So the rest of my peers went on to college and could stand health insurance at that time because, you know, it's just recently that you're allowed to stand till you're 26. But for me, I was kicked off of health insurance when I was 18, and there was no way to afford it, no way to have it. And it was a very clear signal to me that, okay, you know, and whether this was what was to be taken from it or not, it's what I took from it. Okay, well, if you're too poor to go to college and you have to work for a living, you don't get to really survive the same, you know, which is the truth of the matter. If my eyes fail, if my health fails, if something happens and, you know, let's say it interferes with me being able to work, well, that's just too bad. You know, that was your lot in life. So now things have changed a little bit, you know, of course, with the Health Care Act, but that's always being threatened to be repealed. So, you know, for me, the message was sent very early on. There's very social, you know, very much social inequality, and it was the beginning of my social awareness and political involvement.
Did you head to college?
No, I've never been able to afford it. I've, you know, worked since I was 15 years old. I've had to take care of family members. I've, you know, everything else but going to college has been on the agenda. And I've been able to make a really good niche for myself, but it's been purely by luck. I mean, to be completely clear, I think I'm an intelligent person and I hope that I've held my own in that way. But it really has just been talking to people and, you know, getting that foot in the door when I could and going forward with it. And I can't say that other friends of mine who are in similar situations have fared the same at all. It's seriously just a game of luck, you know?
Sarah, thanks a lot for your call. Matthew Stewart from Joe and Sarah. We hear this conviction that it's a setup.
We do. Let me first thank Sarah for sharing her story. And unfortunately, it's all too common. So what's happened in our society is that we took something that I think implicitly was understood as a basic right, a right to life, not in the anti-abortion sense, but in the sense of people having a right to be able to sort of live and be on equal terms in a sort of physical sense with other people. We've turned that into a privilege, and we give it out to people who succeed in the game, and that has that has very serious consequences. Those consequences are showing up in some incredibly alarming statistics. I mean, we have seen that life expectancy among people with lower education and lower income and white people in the middle of the country, that is going down. It's the only place in the industrialized developed world where that's happening. That should really alarm us. And it's a direct consequence of turning every aspect of life into this competition and then having a rigged competition or having a competition that fundamentally works to the advantage of people who come in with a certain number of chips already on the table. If I could address the first caller's issues, I think he points to a certain sense that things are rigged. I think that's very widespread in the country. I know it's definitely out there in the backcountry of Virginia, but I think there is a misunderstanding about the role of government in laying the table for that inequality. A lot of us don't understand that, for example, if doctors make more than carpenters, that's because the government effectively has laid the table for them. And it's done so because it has to some degree fallen captive to lobby groups and so on. That's where you get the regulations or the professional controls and so on that limit the market there and drive up the salaries in an artificial way. So the game is rigged, but don't imagine that that's happening just because people are making dumb decisions. Government is involved in that process.
Yeah, I mean, the AMA controls how you become a doctor and becomes the number of, controls the number of people who become doctors, but they do it sort of in hand in glove with the government. Something like a state board licensing exam.
The government has to allow them to do that, essentially. And that happens in a number of other fields. And I apologize to my friends who are doctors out there. I love you all, but it's part of the game.
We're talking about how wealth and opportunity are shared in this country. How about the game? Is it rigged? Not just for the very rich. Is it good for our democracy? Is this democracy the way we've thought about our country in the past? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
There's nothing like a movie theater on a hot day, and there's nothing like a good show you can binge watch with a cold glass of lemonade. Summer is the perfect time to find your next favorite thing, and Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help. Find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're asking whether a certain class of middle-class Americans have become an aristocracy of their own, wishing other Americans would just strive as hard as they, not realizing other Americans are striving as hard, not realizing they themselves have pulled up the social ladder behind them. You can join the conversation. Do you think we can prosper, innovate, build a future America that's a little more egalitarian than the one we have now? My guest is Matthew Stewart. His article in The Atlantic is called The 9.9% is the New American Aristocracy. There's a link to it on our website, onpointradio.org. Here was the president speaking at the 2017 Boy Scout Jamboree in Virginia last July. What he tells the gathered scouts at this point in the speech was pretty standard fare. The secret to success in life? Wake up each morning excited to go to work.
What makes you want to get up each morning and go to work? You have to find it. If you love what you do and dedicate yourself to your work, then you will gain momentum. And look, you have to. You need the word momentum. You will gain that momentum. And each success will create another success.
If anything, Matthew Stewart, that's the American creed. But part of what your thesis is, in your cover story in The Atlantic, is that we're not rising and falling in response to our gifts and our hard work, but that this class is building a wall behind itself, making itself less permeable, pulling up the ladder. How is it doing that?
Right. And let me first say that was an interesting choice as role model for the American ideal, since after all, Donald Trump didn't exactly start at the bottom. He inherited a huge fortune, and I've seen arguments that he essentially managed to just perform under the Standard & Poor's index in terms of his return on investments. But let's set that aside. How have they done it? Let's talk about one aspect that I think people are intimately familiar with. It's their homes, right? Their neighborhoods. We have these incredibly expensive neighborhoods. Everybody knows this. Everybody wants to come to Boston, spends hours going through Zillow and experiencing sticker shock, right? So where does that come from? Well, we tell ourselves that that is just the result of the booming economy. It's because there's so much productivity here that people will want to, you know, pay these prices. And there's some truth in that. It's definitely the case that we have that the productive centers of the United States economy are where you will find the expensive real estate. But that's just the beginning of the story. Once we have our little neighborhoods, one of the first things we do is we make sure that other people can't move in. So what you see in the United States is a pattern where you have artificial restriction on construction, excessively restrictive zoning regulations that don't allow people to move to where the productive centers are. That has the effect of driving up the prices in those areas still higher, and it drives people to move out of those regions. So the consequence is actually to decrease potential economic growth. You end up with people who could have been working in these productive centers, and they're moving out to cheaper places where they will have less productive, less remunerative work. And then the people within those zip codes, well, they're building the walls. They build their own schools. They invest in their own communities. They turn their already commanding advantages in the economy into still more advantages, and then they pass them along to their children. And by the way, just as to close that out, I think Trump said something about your success builds on your success. Well, that's true, and that's wonderful, and that's why we should all strive to succeed. But if you carry that too far, if you can use your success to ensure your children's success and your grandchildren's success, and it all builds on itself, at some point you end up with a really skewed system, and where people who do have some ability and who have something to offer just have no way of getting in the door.
Our next stop is Hollywood, Florida. Matthew, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Okay.
Well, my thing is that, like, I feel like it's like the middle class has sort of, or just society in general has sort of just ingrained in my generation, because I'm a millennial, has sort of ingrained in our generation that in order to be successful, we have to go to college. And I have so many friends that had that like crammed down their throat almost, that they went to college and took out all these loans and are so up to their necks in debt because they were convinced that if they did that, they would get a great job. And none of them really have great jobs. And I mean, like, it seemed almost like getting a blue collar job is like a taboo thing now, where you can still be extremely successful in a blue collar job. But it's like, at least a lot of people I know, like, the fact that if their children weren't going to college, they took that as like a direct insult to their own success. And like, if you could just go to a technical school and get a blue collar job and do extremely well. So I just wanted to know what your opinion was on that.
I'll put that to Matthew Stewart. Thanks for your call, Matthew.
Yeah, thanks, Matthew. That's a great point. So one of the big things that's happened in the United States over the past 50 years is that labor has been disempowered. By labor, I'm referring to what I think you're calling blue-collar work. So union membership has gone down. Rights of workers have been stripped away. I think there was a Supreme Court decision that came out this morning that's continuing that process. And the result of that is that blue-collar work in the United States, unlike the white-collar work, is not particularly competitive when compared to other nations. So you'd really rather be a blue-collar worker in Germany, for example, which is a more productive economy overall, than you would in the United States. And that's curious, right? And the reason why that happens is that we do have this myth that college is the ticket. Here's the reality. College is the ticket for a certain subset at the top. And that's why people compete so vigorously and sometimes viciously to get into that sliver at the top. For the people that are down below, you may get a great education, but the idea that you're going to be able to latch on to those special premiums that are out there on offering in the economy, that I don't think has that much basis. And here I'll tell you something that I learned in the research. I was going off intuitions, but one of the great things about being a writer is you get to go into other people's research and look into what the data is showing you. And I wasn't sure how much of an income boost you get from different kinds of colleges, but it's pretty dramatic. And I don't think this information has gotten out far enough. It does turn out that if you go to the 50 or so most selective colleges, your earnings down the road are likely to be substantially higher, and I mean on the order of 2 to 3 times higher than they are for the average college goer. So the idea that college is the ticket, it isn't backed up by the numbers. It's certain kinds of college are the ticket, and the rest you should consider for education, which, by the way, I'm all in favor of. But you need to look at the economics very closely.
Baltimore, Maryland is next. Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for taking my call. I was actually probably one of your last caller's friends that he was talking about. I come from a blue-collar family. I'm the first person in my family to go to college, and I'm very proud of it. I'm very thankful for that opportunity. But I'm $75,000 in debt and paying $400 a month I am not even paying on the premium of my loan. I don't regret going to school, and I'm glad for the work that I've done, but I wanted to get a welding certificate coming out of high school because I knew waiting tables through college wasn't going to pay enough to go to University X and University Y. And it is. It's a trap. It's a big trap, in my opinion.
But it's a trap that snaps shut only in recent decades. You know, I worked behind the counter of a convenience store all through college and paid a private school tuition with that money that I earned both during the week, during the fall and spring semester, and then weekends and all through the summer. If I did that same job today, that same school is literally 11 times more expensive. I was making $2.25 an hour. That job at the convenience store doesn't pay $25 an hour now. You do the same things that we were told to do 30 and 40 and 50 years ago, but you end up in Mary's trap, Matthew Stewart.
That's right. And Mary, thanks for sharing. And again, unfortunately, I have heard and I continue to hear very similar stories. And Ray's point, I think, is really on the mark. People like Ray, if I may generalize here, we're old enough that we've seen a significant change. And it's frankly an alarming change because when I was going to college, I think it was understood that going to college was a good deal all around. I borrowed money. I was able to pay it off eventually after I got out of graduate school. A little late, but I got it done. But there was no doubt that it made sense. So the phenomenon we're talking about is a pretty recent thing. And I'm sorry to say, but it reflects these very fundamental, very deep forces in our society that are pulling us apart, this inequality at all ends of the spectrum, from the very top to the bottom, that are separating the classes and then creating very, very different deals for people in the different at the different levels. I've split it up into three levels, but there are many more. But it's the numbers show that we've got a very, very serious problem.
Because the children in your new aristocracy aren't saddled with $75,000 in debt when they come out of school. Their parents have used 529s and striven hard to grow the balance so that they march down the aisle with their newly minted sheepskin without that burden, month in, month out, throughout the rest of their 20s. Charlotte, North Carolina is next. Scott, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Ray. I've been listening to the program this, today, and to a certain extent, I'm kind of flabbergasted. And I say that, why? I'm not an old man. I'm in my 50s. I'm an attorney. I have worked since the age of 11. I worked at a time when, yes, I do agree that perhaps that if you worked in the convenience store, you could pay for school. But I went above and beyond. I worked at the age of 11. When I was a teenager, I started my own business. Whether or not I was selling candy apples after school, or I created an ice cream business that put me through college and graduate school. Here, I'm in my 50s and I'm an attorney, and I should be at the end of my career. But I have a new career. And I've taken the money that I've earned through my sweat and blood, and I've invested it in my community by means of investing it in housing, and some housing, which is housing that are for individuals that can't afford housing. But I got to tell you, one of the things that I see, and what I'm saying to you is I'm driving into the office right now, but I just spent the last 4 days slaving at my houses, working at my houses. And one of the things that I see and one of the things that I've come up against is I can't find anybody to work. I pay a good wage. I still can't find anybody to work. I had to take off from the office yesterday because workers didn't come in. Why? Because it was in the 90s. They weren't about ready to sweat. And to a certain extent, what your guest is selling here is selling a myth, because I'm looking at a housing project right now, and you know what I see there? Every person that is on that ladder that I'm looking at right now is an immigrant that's come to the country here that is working in jobs with the hope of doing something. And to suggest that I'm a litigator, and I'm flabbergasted that I can't get my words across here.
Well, Scott, thank you very much for your call. I want to give Matthew Stewart a chance to respond. But I think your frustration is echoed by a lot of the people who've been signing in on the website today saying, well, what would you have us do? This is what we did to get ahead, and I'm not going to apologize. If anything, I'm a little annoyed that somebody's pointing to it and saying there's something wrong with it. Matthew Stewart.
Right. I guess I should preface this by saying that I think it's terrific when people strive. And I think that if people don't work, they basically should not receive substantial rewards. So I don't have a problem with the American ideal. Here's a basic problem that we face. In the United States, it's pretty hard to make any kind of discussion about class, to make any kind of social critique without people understanding it as a personal insult or a comment on their personal life choices. I think we all I want to draw attention to these privileges. And by the way, the privileges do exist. And while notwithstanding the fact that many people work hard and their success is a function of their hard work, when you look at the numbers, you cannot deny that there is privilege and that it is being passed around. But what I would like people to do is not simply express contrition or, you know, feel guilty. I frankly don't think their personal interventions or changes are going to matter that much. I want them to look at their experience and understand what is going wrong with our society as a whole. So don't take your personal experience where you have, you know, you've been a great worker and you've gotten all your just rewards as proof that the system is working. Take a look at the system. Take a look at the experiences of other people. Listen to the other callers on this show and try to put all of that together and not just generalize from your one individual experience of America. Because let me just tell you, you know, my experience has been terrific. I have everything to be grateful for. But does that mean that I think that the United States is on a sustainable trajectory? Does that mean that I think that this kind of inequality is not going to lead us to very dangerous situations? In fact, I think it's led us to that right now. So I think I would just ask people to not see this just as some kind of personal indictment, but to see it as an opportunity to get involved in seeking the right kinds of changes in our society.
We don't have time to have a long discussion about what a more open structure would look like, but you're saying that the top 10% have some role in keeping the opportunity structure open.
Well, I think the top 10%, part of the reason why I pick on them, this may not be all that convincing right now, but honestly, it's because I like them. They're my people. I think on the whole, our education has worked and it's produced a large class of very enlightened, very tolerant, globally minded individuals. I want these people to get involved in helping to change our society, try to strip away the sources of monopoly power, to re-empower labor, to give everybody a better chance in terms of setting their health care and education opportunities in a balanced way.
Matthew Stewart is a philosopher and the author of several books. His article in The Atlantic is called The 9.9% is the New American Aristocracy. Matthew, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Anna Bowman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Kotsonis, Allison Poli, Catherine Proctor, Tanya Raleigh, Jeremy Relosa, and James Ross. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Ray Suarez.